good use. But we begin with another about turn in the great HRT debate. First, we're told it's safe, good for the bones, the heart, the skin, hair and hot flushes. Then it's not safe. It can cause heart disease and breast cancer, and it's gone to and fro several times, resting most recently on be very wary, and the Department of Health advises taking the lowest dose possible for as short a time as possible. But then comes another re-evaluation, this time from the International Menopause Society, presented at the World Congress on the Menopause in Madrid. So now, what are we to do? Well, Valerie Beryl is Professor of Epidemiology at Oxford University. Dr. Tony Mandel is a consultant gynaecologist in Rochdale and represents the British Menopause Society. He joins us from the Madrid Congress. Tony, what are you saying now is safe?
Well, it's what we're trying to say is to look at the data that's occurred in the last 5 years when there were terrible scares, a bit like the Salmonella scare, and a million women came off HRT in the UK. There are risks attached to HRT. But we're much better at defining them. And there are benefits attached to HRT, which, again, can be defined pretty well.
Let's just go through the ones that have really scared women. Breast cancer. What do you say on breast cancer, which we've been told it's really dangerous, it can cause breast cancer?
Well, there are risks attached to some types of HRT with breast cancer. Estrogen alone, there's supposedly no great increased risk in the first 7 years. Some of the other types, there are more increased risk. But these risks are less than the risk of breast cancer if you smoke or if you're overweight or if you drink a lot of alcohol. So there are risks, but they're much slighter than some of the other lifestyle risks attached to breast cancer.
What about heart disease?
Heart disease, it appears, I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, in a group of older women, there was a high incidence of heart disease, and this may be the case. But in the 50 to 60-year-old range, and they're re-looking at the data, it appears that there may well be benefits. Now, they're not recommending using it for preventing heart disease, but apparently there is a reduction in death rate in that age range of 30% in the trial group that was looked at in America.
And given that there are some risks there that you talk about, we know that it's supposed to be good for our bones, that we don't get osteoporosis if we use HRT. To what extent does that benefit outweigh the risks, in your view?
Well, the osteoporosis thing has been strengthened. It does prevent fractures. It's very good for it. And we no longer recommend it for that in the UK, as Valerie will tell you. But you've got to face the fact women live a lot longer now, as men do. A woman of 50 has probably got another 40 years of life. Women are much more at risk of getting thin bones, osteoporosis and fractures, probably four times than men. And they're much more at risk of getting things like cognitive decline. So we really do need to look at what we're going to do for women in their 70s and 80s to keep them fit and healthy.
So, Valerie, it seems that Tony is suggesting that we can keep ourselves more healthy if we go on taking it, and we shouldn't worry too much about the risks that we know are there. How do you respond to that report?
Well, I think this report is a highly selective report. It just quotes a very small part of the evidence, and actually often they misquote the evidence that's out there that's been collected over the last 5 years. I mean, I will say the government that you mentioned, actually the regulatory body which sets standards, which determines what inserts go into packages and so forth, have just done a major review of all the evidence that this same group have looked at. But they've reviewed the totality of the evidence, not just bits of it. And they come to quite different conclusions. And then the conclusion you said, they haven't really changed, that women should take HRT for a shorter time as possible, a lower dose as possible.
So, Tony, you've been highly selective in what you've used.
Well, can I just say that I wasn't one of the 40 national experts that said this, but I think I would take some issue with what Valerie says, who, incidentally, I believe is on the panel that makes the government advice. I don't think there's any doubt that HRT is very good for preventing osteoporosis, and there aren't any very good alternatives for younger women. Without things which don't have side effects or have limited time to use. So I think that the government should review its position on the osteoporosis prevention issue. I'm not saying for a minute that HRT is the answer to everything. But adjusting health and lifestyle, and with perhaps or without HRT, is, I think, going to be very important for the future.
But if hold on a sec, Valerie.
Yes.
If you're saying, Tony, that it's good for osteoporosis, are you saying that women should take it forever?
Well, I'm saying that if you had a high likelihood of having spinal fractures and all the rest of it, you might consider, well, is there a tiny risk of breast cancer, but worse or better than having the fractures? And really, it's got to be the woman's choice. And if you've had parents who've got osteoporosis, it's a pretty awful disease.
Valerie?
So, yes, can I say, I mean, there's no doubt about the protection against fractures, and the MHRA, the government, say that very clearly. But you have to be taking HRT to get the protection. As soon as you stop, it goes back to where you were to start with. So, I mean, you know, the question is, can you take, as Jenny said, can you really take it for 40 years? Because I want to mention two things about the breast cancer and heart disease, because the breast cancer risks are not the way you described. It is true that being overweight is a risk factor, but you have to be like 25 stone to be the equivalent of the effects of HRT. Alcohol, too, you have to drink 10 drinks a day to the equivalent of HRT.
But Valerie, a lot of women drink a lot more than they used to.
10 drinks a day. Well, I'm saying they're the equivalents. It's 10 drinks a day and being 25 stone.
I would take issue with that.
Well, you may, but that's what the evidence is. Sorry.
Go on, Tony. Question the evidence.
I don't think it helps to get into arguing figures. It's philosophy we want. And the philosophy is that women need to have better input for health, lifestyle, and support when they get older. And if we say that we're never ever going to allow people to say estrogen safe for more than a very short time, then we're never going to find out what answers there may be.
No, we do
and,
know.
And the one important area I think that is important is that recent brain scan studies show that estrogen is absolutely vitally important in the areas of the brain concerned with memory and cognition.
And the trials show an increased risk of cognitive decline and dementia, and you know this.
Hang on, Valerie, are you saying our brains won't be better by taking HRT?
It's sort of like we know from these trials that we keep quoting the risks are increased. And I think that it really is not doing women a service to say these things.
Tony, can I just put one more point to you?
Yeah.
And that is that often doctors like you are said to be pushing HRT because you've got a financial interest in promoting HRT, because you get sponsored or paid for going to conferences by the drug companies. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I'm quite astonished because having written a book on managing the menopause without oestrogen and edited a book on that, the fees of which go to charity, it's fine, we do go to conferences and sometimes we have support from that. Valerie knows because she was due to be at the conference yesterday in Madrid. But what I'm saying is I don't think there is a financial interest there. And doctors get many other financial incentives, like prescribing statins and things like that as a GP. So I don't think the right thing. I've certainly not made anything out of promoting HRT as such.
And Valerie, one final point to you. Isn't it a bit potty to say to women, only take the lowest dose for as short a time as possible? Because when you stop taking it, you get hot flushes and the other symptoms anyway.
You know, I wish this body would do more research on actually how to prevent menopausal symptoms, because they are a problem, and nobody's saying women shouldn't take HRT, but it's very variable how long it lasts, and women have to just come to decisions. But they should not be told it's safe, it's okay, there are no risks. And this is the problem. They have to balance, and it's an individual woman's decision, but she mustn't be given misinformation. I find that very of great concern, that a body can come out and misrepresent the evidence and try and point out things are okay.
We must leave it there again. Professor Valerie Beryl and Dr. Tony Mander, thank you both very much indeed. Now, Rafe Vaughan Williams, pronounced it wrongly there, is widely considered the most brilliant composer this country has ever produced, although there are those who criticise the pastoral quality of his more popular works. But a documentary which goes out tomorrow on BBC 4 introduces the audience to a much wider body of work than most of us would be familiar with. It's called The Passions of Vaughan Williams and suggests he was often influenced not by the lark or the countryside, but by the women in his life. There was a fondness for young students and a long ménage à trois with Ursula, a woman 40 years his junior, and his first wife, Adeline. Family friends remember what happened.
He did a great deal for her, And, I mean, I think more than most husbands would do. I mean, I think he was to really look after her, give her baths and help her do her hair. But it was hopeless. It just got worse and the pain was bad.
I should think the question was that there was very little sex in the marriage with Adeline, whereas Ursula sort of transformed his life completely. I think when he met Ursula, he'd never had a love affair like that before.
She was really extraordinarily beautiful herself. Very, very pronounced and definite. Whereas Adeline was the other thing, very sort of wispy. So I understand how it all worked. And it was lovely for Rafe. He really was lucky.
Belinda Norman Butler and Simona Pakenham, and I'm joined by the arts journalist Lynn Walker and John Bridcutt, who made the television film. John, why did you want to make this film now?
Partly because I've always loved Vaughan Williams' music. I was brought up on it at school. In fact, I played in a school performance of The Lark Ascending. So I felt a great empathy with his music. But I felt that in a way, the full range of it hadn't been properly appreciated, at least in the wider audience. And this anniversary year, 50 years after he died, seemed an appropriate time to do that.
So, Lynn, what did you learn about Vaughan Williams that illuminates the work that you hadn't known before?
I think one of the things that came across was just what a terribly charming and humane man he was. Now, I'm not saying that that illuminates the work. I think his life had very curious twists and turns in it, and I don't think you can tell where somebody's going unless you know where they're coming from. And the fact that he did have a very strange marriage to a woman who clearly was intellectually his equal, but certainly didn't satisfy his physical needs. In fact, she may even have been gay, we don't know, but they certainly didn't seem to have what you might call normal, if any relationship can be called normal.
She was a relative of Virginia Woolf.
She was, which says quite a lot in itself, and she had a very overbearing family. And I think when he did eventually find somebody with whom he could share perhaps the joy of just normal kind of love, it did unlock something in him. And I think there probably is something to be realised now when you listen to the music. He was very enigmatic, for example, about some of his symphonies. He wouldn't say what they were about, the Fourth Symphony. And he made jokes about Dorking Bypass and things like that. Or was it Hitler? Or was it, in fact, something he may not even have realised himself, a real pent-up frustration inside him?
John, how important do you think the women were to what he created?
I think they were immensely important. I think if you look at the Serenade to Music, which is a most wonderful, radiant choral piece, apparently written for the 50th anniversary of Sir Henry Wood conducting, it was actually written within a few weeks of his first meeting with Ursula. And although he chose the words from Shakespeare, he asked for her approval, which she gave to the choice that he'd made. And indeed, she was a great, had an immense literary sensibility. She was a poet herself. And throughout the rest of Vaughan Williams's life, he relied on Ursula for her critical assessment of words that he might choose. And indeed, she wrote a lot for him to set to music. So that piece, that Serenade to Music, is so glowing with the romance of young love, which fits the words very well.
And but she was also young, he wasn't so young then.
No, that's right, but perhaps, you know, we tend to be the victims of photographs, still photographs, that capture Vaughan Williams always 65 plus. There are just a few of him when he was younger, and we tend to think of him as an old man, and I think probably people of 65 would say, hey, you know, the world always thinks of us as old, and in fact, we're still young inside.
No, I'm not suggesting that 65 is old, but I'm suggesting to take up with a woman 40 years your junior is perhaps a little suspect.
Not for a creative artist. I mean, look at Picasso and his women. Do we appreciate Picasso's art any less because we know about his women? In fact, it probably adds to it.
Look at Janáček.
Yeah, indeed. And Messiaen, for example, whose wife was in a mental home for a long time, and he was very frustrated with his passions for the woman he couldn't marry because he was a Catholic. Walton's First Symphony, inspired by the girlfriends. Elgar's Enigma Variations has yet another enigma, a love who sailed out of his life to New Zealand. So I think that in many, many creative artists, there is passion. And in fact, I don't think I'm very interested in a creative artist who isn't inspired by passion, because what else is there?
But there are stories, John, in your film of, frankly, naff behaviour. I mean, he climbs up the stairs at the Royal College of Music, spying on beautiful students. He pats their knees. I got a feeling of a slightly grubby behaviour.
Well, I think that's perhaps looking at things with the, with, you know, 2020 hindsight. I mean, it was a different world then. I don't think there was anything grubby about his behaviour. I think he did delight in beautiful women. There's no doubt of that. He loved the company of women. And as one of the interviewees in the film said to me, he liked women as well. It wasn't just a physical thing. He really enjoyed their company. So Ursula had apparently said to one of her friends that with these various other young women, there was a lot of physical affection, but nothing from the waist down.
I think, if I may say, that it was always charm and not smarm. And I didn't think of him as a grubby old man. I'd really like to have met him. I mean, I knew lots of people, music lecturers, who were really, frankly, horrible. And I don't think Vaughan Williams comes into that category. I think there's just a certain amount of love of young life. And it wasn't just women. I mean, John's film focuses on that. But he was terrifically supportive to young male composers. He really championed their music. He
Indeed.
Was a lover of youth in the nicest possible sense and in the best possible way.
How sorry did you feel for Adeline, though, when you were watching the documentary, Lynn, especially after Ursula's husband had died and he brought her to live with them, and there's a story of them, you know, the two of them in twin beds, and Ursula in the middle holding both their hands during the Blitz.
That's actually in Ursula's biography. That's not any new revelation. That to me was, in fact, quite touching. I felt they had become friends. And in a sense, Adeline may have been quite relieved in a way, because she wasn't particularly interested in a physical relationship with Vaughan Williams. Her terrible, painful arthritis prevented her travelling to concerts with him. She was perhaps glad that he had companionship and somebody who was there to do that side of things.
He married Ursula, John, when Adeline died. What happened to Ursula? Because she survived him by, what, 49 years?
Yes, indeed. And I think that says something about the extraordinary relationship that they had. She was an incredibly attractive woman and remains so. Even when I met her at the age when she was 95, you could still see this incredible beauty, an amazing smile. And yet she was devoted to that memory of Rafe. I think she was someone who always enjoyed life. I don't think she shut herself away in Queen Victoria like widowhood. She was always a party goer, and I think she lived life to the full. But there was something special about that relationship with a man 39 years her senior, which stayed with her right to the end.
And Lynn, was he this country's greatest composer?
Well, I was intrigued that Anthony Payne, in John's film, who completed Elgar's Third Symphony, actually said he thought Vaughan Williams was a better composer. And I think that this film and Tony Palmer's film will make people listen again to the music. And Jenny, if I could just say, I was really touched by the fact that all these very elderly women still mentioned his name with a sparkle in their eye and said how much they had all loved him.
You were very lucky, John, weren't you, to get all those friends. I mean, lucky, I suppose, in that he had so many young women friends who were still alive for you to talk to.
Yes, I mean, so lucky, because these moments, you know, that they slip through our grasp if we're not careful. And it's wonderful, you know, Belinda Norman Butler, who I believe is now 99, and, you know, her appearance and the vigour and the warmth of her memory belie that at great age. And quite incredible.
And finally, what matters really is the music. And if this makes us listen to the music in a different way or in a new way or just listen to it, gosh, that's great.
Well, Lynn Walker and John Bridcutt, thank you very much for being with us. And just a reminder that the documentary is on BBC 4 tomorrow evening. Now, still to come in today's programme, you may think that old bra is beyond shame, but Oxfam may be able to put it to good use. We go to their Waste Saver recycling plant and the serial episode 4 of Sister Agnes Investigates. Now, if you've been an Archers fan for a long time, you'll remember back in 2002 when Jazza started to get into trouble with a drug called ketamine, and it turned out to be Alistair's partner in the veterinary practice who'd been selling it. Ketamine is generally used as an anaesthetic for horses, but it has increasingly become a clubber's drug. It was made illegal 2 years ago and is classified C alongside anabolic steroids and minor tranquilizers. Cannabis is, of course, going back up to B. But despite that, it's gaining in popularity. Melissa is a regular user and told me earlier this morning about the cocktail of drugs she takes.
I take ecstasy, ketamine and coke.
And when did you start to use ketamine?
When I was at university. It was one of the new drugs that people were trying out. So it was something just we sort of came